Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Modern life has become a constant stream of electronic devices demanding our attention. What are the consequences when we choose cell phones, BlackBerries, email, or Facebook over real person-to-person contact? Winifred Gallagher, our guest in this edition of Radio Curious, suggests that we take control of our own priorities, controlling electronic devices, and not let them control us. Winifred Gallagher is the author of Wrapped, Attention and the Focused Life, a book that explores how we allow the limited and valuable resource that is our attention to be electronically squandered and thus not used to our personal needs or benefit. I spoke with Winifred Gallagher by phone from her home in New York City on November 30th, 2009, and began by asking her about how focus shapes our lives. Winifred Gallagher, welcome to Radio Curious.
I'm delighted to be with you.
In your book, Wrapped, you say somewhat, if we don't know about it, we can't think about it. If we don't know where Kazakhstan is, we can't really think about Kazakhstan. I take that comment and the comment that you have, nothing in life is as important as you think it is while you're thinking about it.
Well, those are two pretty different ideas. If we could take part A first, it really helps understand the whole concept of the book, which is the importance of paying attention, if you understand some basic information about how attention works in your brain. You can't intuit it. You need to understand the facts. So in the past decade or so, neuroscientists have figured out how attention works in the brain. And its basic mechanism is a process of selection. You either pay attention to this thing or that thing. When you focus on a particular sight or sound, thought or feeling, your brain sort of quote-unquote photographs it, which makes it part of what you call reality, which is your kind of mental album of the world, which means that it can affect how you feel, how you behave. What you don't pay attention to might as well not exist, at least for you. So it makes an enormous amount of difference, as you said. If you've never focused on Kazakhstan, it doesn't exist for you in a sense. This is maybe for most of us not that important where Kazakhstan is concerned, but it's very important when we're dealing with other people in relationships or when we're trying to work productively.
Can you give us some examples?
It's particularly important when you're dealing with what psychologists call negative life events and what the rest of us call things like broken hearts and pink slips and bad biopsies. Because nature evolved in us two ways to pay attention that protects our survival. The bottom-up attention is an involuntary form of attention, and that asks the question, what is the obvious thing here, Barry, for you to focus on? And right now it's probably my voice. But if you were in your car, it might be a red traffic signal or a wailing siren. So that's bottom-up involuntary attention. The key to controlling your experience is voluntary top-down attention, which asks a different question. Barry, what do you want to concentrate on right now? Do you want to concentrate on the noise from the street outside or the sound of my voice, the jealous thought or the peaceful thought? So that voluntary form of attention, top-down attention, that's really your tool for controlling your experience. Now, where we get into trouble with attention is that nature sort of wired us to pay more attention to distressing emotions like fear and sadness than to nice feelings. We evolved to pay bottom-up involuntary attention to these negative emotions for a very practical reason. The pain they cause is meant to motivate us to solve the underlying cause of the pain. So you're upset by a quarrel you had with your spouse, you make amends. You're worried about your child, you call the teacher. You're angered by some injustice that you witnessed, you protest. In those examples, focusing on a negative emotion is very useful. However, we often get stuck on painful or destructive ideas and feelings that serve no problem-solving purpose. I'll never lose those 10 pounds, or she was always the favorite, or what if I fail on this project? In those cases, shifting your attention away from these useless thoughts to more productive ones, like I'll lose the weight if I go to the gym, or the way to proceed with this difficult project is to get to work now. Shifting to those kinds of thoughts is not just pleasant, but also practical. When you focus on something that's positive and constructive, experiments show that your visual field actually broadens. You actually see more stuff than you would see if you were in a negative or neutral mood. And even more important, so does your mental perspective. So you literally see what we call the big picture. You have more options to consider. This is very crucial fact when you're in a decision-making situation. In contrast, when you focus on negative thoughts and feelings, your reality literally shrinks. Your visual field shrinks. You see fewer things than you would if you were in a positive mood. And so does your conceptual reality, which contracts, as we all know, when something terrible happens to us, it seems like our reality contracts until that's like the only thing in the world. So, you know, lots of research shows that this dynamic plays out all across the whole range of mental illnesses. Depressed people focus on the very things that will make them feel hopeless and helpless. Anxious people focus on threatening things. Hypochondriacs focus on symptoms. So when we're dealing with our emotions, it's really important to be directing your focus and not be letting the tail wag the dog, so to speak.
Well, let's talk about how we came to be in this position that you've just described. You say the research shows. What is the evolutionary behavior in our species behind this?
Well, nature, most of all, wants to enhance your reproductive fitness. So you evolved one very practical form of attention, your bottom-up involuntary attention, so that if there's suddenly a vicious dog is snarling when you're on a walk, or if you see a crack of lightning ahead of you when you're in a forest, nature has wired you so that you will not miss those things. You will pay attention to them because they're very salient things that can affect your survival. But where it comes to improving the quality of your life, you don't want to let your involuntary attention just attach on the most salient thing that's going on in your world. You want to pick it. Maybe when you went to work this morning, you had a fight with your partner. But when you get to the office, you need to work. So your bottom-up attention is saying, oh, the fight, it's so upsetting. Let's replay it. What is she going to say next? Oh, I'm so angry. But you can't afford to do that because you need to get your work done. So fortunately, you have top-down attention, voluntary attention. So you have the ability to say, I'm now going to put that argument aside, and I'm going to shift my focus to this document that I have to finish. So evolution has given us these two wonderful ways to live our lives efficiently and productively. One takes care of emergency situations, if you will, and the other lets you make choices about what you want to do that affect your more long-range well-being.
But it's making those choices knowingly as opposed to having them made for us accidentally.
Yes, and that's particularly important now. When I was going traveling around talking to people about RAPT, I spent a lot of time in airports and on airplanes, and I was just stupefied by, you know, the pilot would say, well, you know, you've got 5 minutes, you've got to turn off your devices, and these otherwise sane-looking people start grabbing for their little devices and punching them like mad. We are letting these machines choose our focuses for us and forgetting that they are our electronic servants, not our masters. I mean, to me, the classic example is you make a decision to have lunch with a friend, you go into the restaurant, you sit down, and you both put your smartphones on the table beside you. And the tacit agreement there is whoever calls me on my phone is more important than you, who I'm actually spending time with.
In this edition of Radio Curious, we're visiting with Winifred Gallagher and talking about her book Rapt, R-A-P-T, Rapt, Attention and the Focused Life. But let's stay with how our attention is being commercially diverted. Can you address that?
Yeah, it's actually kind of a shockingly underreported area. I think I have five kids who range in age from, you know, college age into young adults. And it's just amazing to me to see how clever these companies are in designing these electronic products that are very, very seductive and fun to use. And you can watch a 15-year-old kid texting like mad with the thumbs going like a mile a minute, and they're also got one eye on the laptop screen, and maybe they've got the TV on, and you think, oh, these kids must be really accomplishing much more than I, you know, something that I can't do at that age. Unfortunately, the kids are involved in this very shallow kind of activity that isn't going to serve them well when they have to, like, sit down and read a real book and approach it critically and talk about what ideas it's presenting and how they might differ from those ideas. No matter how fast you can text, it's not going to help you with that. So I think, you know, the one issue is just the incredibly slick and seductive way that the companies know what young kids want and deliver it to them. I mean, I think my favorite example of that is a year or two ago, of the 10 top-selling novels in Japan, five of them were written by young women on their cell phones. Another issue is, as you mentioned, advertising. Advertising is now so stimulating that very serious neuroscientists are talking about it as addictive. They've figured out that by flashing something very salient, very novel at you in very rapid fire pace, because, you know, we evolved to pay attention to things that are new and changing, you literally can't tear your eyes away from it. And this is really appalling when you're talking about, you know, little kids.
Well, that's true on television and on the computer. And where else in terms of small children? I remember when my children were small, in the grocery store, there would be the big comic character eyes at their eye level in the breakfast food department.
Right. I think the worst thing for little kids is still television. The research shows that people are watching more and more television. Television used to be maybe a family would have one in the living room in the old days, then maybe there would be one in the parents' bedroom, let's say, or a den or something. Now, virtually every room in the house often has a television.
Can you talk about the Italian research of the frequency of sexual relations between yeah. couples who have televisions in their bedroom?
They did a study which showed that of married couples, the couples who had televisions in their bedrooms had half as much sex as the couples who did not have televisions in their bedrooms. Having a TV or a Stairmaster in your bedroom is about as much of an anti-aphrodisiac as I can imagine.
Well, what's the psychological activity that goes along with those two?
Again, we evolved to pay attention to whatever is most salient in the environment. And basically, things that change are very salient. I mean, if you go way back or you even think about like an animal in the forest, something that's likely to either be something to eat or something that's going to eat you is much likelier to be something new and unfamiliar or changing in your environment than something that you're very accustomed to that's always been there. So we like other animals are attracted to things that are new and changeable. So that makes us real suckers for electronic media.
Let's apply those to extroverted personalities versus introverted personalities and see how they compare.
Well, an extroverted personality, we think about it mostly in terms of social extroversion, so that somebody like Bill Clinton, who it was said of that he literally couldn't leave a restaurant until he had like shaken every hand in the room, that kind of thing. As the word suggests, extroverted means looking outside yourself for stimulation. An extroverted person could also be very interested in extreme sports or something like that, so across the line. So the extroverted person generally is going to be much more swayed by new stimuli coming in. So that kind of a person is going to be more vulnerable to being led around by the nose by the cell phone or by the email pings than a more introverted person. Introverted, as the word suggests, is someone who has so much internal stimuli, things going on in their own brain, that they don't need very much input coming in from outside in order to feel and function well. So this would include lots of artists, scientists, academics, people like that who have a lot going on between their ears and don't need to have a lot of external demands on them in order to feel and function well. No matter what your temperament, you have to be aware of the problem and think about it before you can take steps to solve it. And I have been amazed as I've traveled around and talked to groups where it just doesn't seem to have dawned on people that they can turn off the cell phone. If they have an important project to do, they can turn off the cell phone, they can silence the little email you got mail, they can shut the door, and they can do their work. And then 90 minutes later, which is about the optimum time to focus on a challenging task, 90 minutes later, then return your phone calls, return your email. We don't have to return every message that we get the minute we get it. And in fact, every time you interrupt your workflow, rebooting your brain to get back to where you were can take up to 20 minutes. People talk about multitasking as being a good thing. It's a very inefficient thing. You'd actually do much better doing task A than moving on calmly to task B. It's been shown repeatedly in experiments that when you multitask, what you're actually doing, you think you're doing two things at once, what you're actually doing is moving very rapidly between those two things and doing neither of them as well.
Let's talk for a minute about people who might be characterized as less privileged than people who have cell phones and computers. They are encumbered by this same ability to work from either the bottom up involuntarily or the top down voluntarily, but they're more concerned with food and shelter and staying warm. How would you relate this information? Would it be the same way? How might we grab their attention so that they could focus on their needs and perhaps to what others call a more interesting life?
Well, you know, that's a huge question.
This is Radio Curious.
It would take an awful lot of experts from different fields to answer, but I would just look at one piece of it. So I've done a lot of research on the American home, and one of my favorite statistics is that there are more homes without toilets than without televisions. So even in the lowest socioeconomic strata where people are struggling, the chances are excellent that they have a television and perhaps have it on more than somebody who's going for other goals and monitoring it more closely. I mean, now in New York City, where I live, if you get into a taxi cab, there is a television screen embedded in the seat right in front of your face. It's like squawking, squawking, squawking. If you go in an airport, when was the last time you tried to read a book in an airport? It can be a nightmare because you have to listen to CNN at the same time.
So what is the social goal in our nation in promoting these?
I think the same way that we're having a financial crisis and an energy crisis, and they have forced us to look at some hard realities, I think we are approaching a real attentional crisis that is going to force us to think about the fact that attention is a finite resource. It's like your time and your money. You only have so much to spend in your lifetime. Where are you going to spend it? And we can't just go squandering it all over the place. The price we pay for this constant interruption and constant commercials is we don't feel and function as well as we would if we were able to focus on one thing at a time. One of the most powerful findings in all of the literature of behavioral science is the importance of control, feeling that you are in control of your experience. When you don't feel like you're controlling your experience, there's almost nothing that's as stressful.
When you talk about a pending crisis of attention, usually crises come after there's a serious realization on the part of the people who are affected that this is, in fact, a crisis.
Yeah, and I think has been true. All of a sudden, gas is $5 a gallon, then you start thinking about energy. I think we are approaching the point where so many people are feeling almost frantic. I talked to a very prominent researcher at the National Institute of Health the other day who said that after work, when he gets home, he has to answer a minimum of 150 emails.
I guess has to is the operative word there.
Yeah, people are letting this precious finite resource be squandered by the whims of the culture.
So how then is one to resist that?
Really, the first step is recognizing the problem and realizing that you do have the power not to be enslaved by the gadgets. If I'm going to the movies and I know I'm going to have to turn off the phone anyway, I mean, what could be more heartbreaking than these stories about teenagers texting while they're driving? In the amount of time that it takes you to glance down at your cell phone, you are traveling the length of a football field. And we are literally killing ourselves and each other because we can't wait to send some often very trivial message. We have to start exercising some control here.
Well, that's an interesting concept as to how will it become socially acceptable, socially popular to not answer text messages and exercise control by leaving the cell phone elsewhere.
I had a dinner party the other night because I enjoy cooking and seeing my friends in my home, and this fellow came and he actually was sitting right next to me and he pulled out his phone and put it on the table. And I said, no, sorry, not in my house. I mean, I think we have to make some decisions about what are we prioritizing. Barry, if you say the most important thing in life is spending time with your loved ones, and you go home, and instead of having dinner and hanging out with your loved ones, you're on your computer all the time, I have to say there's a dissonance there, right? We have to think about what is important and then tailor the gadgets around what's important to you.
So the question is, who is in charge, the commercial advocates or the individuals?
You can't palm it all off on commerce. I think we ourselves have to make decisions. It's like a revelation, the idea that I have to know what is important in my life, and then I prioritize my other activities around those important things, my work, my family, my spiritual practice, whatever those things are. You have to start there. We can't just blame it on the companies.
The reason I talk about the commercial advocates is because that's what trains societies and trains families. And as you talk about the devotion to what is new and important, I think that's manifested on a frequent basis by people who have the television on while they're eating.
Family dinner is an excellent thing to bring up here. As something that almost all American families, if you ask them to prioritize experiences, they'd say family dinner is a very important experience. It's a good thing. It builds strong families. It keeps parents and kids together. It's been shown to be very good for combating obesity and drug abuse among adolescents, all those kinds of things. It's a good thing. This is a staggering statistic. Even when everybody in the family is at home, 17% of families will, if everybody's home, have dinner together. So, I mean, imagine that. So we're saying family dinner is very important. It's we all get together and we focus on each other. It's very important. But we don't do it. We can't really blame that on a company. That's us. We have to decide what is really important to us and put our focus there. And very often there's a big gap between those two things. Where we, you know, the expression pay attention is no accident. Attention is mental money. You pay it out. Where are you paying your attention? That's what you value. So maybe you value surfing the web more than having dinner with your family, but at least know that about yourself.
So you're saying establish those values. Determine what is appropriate for you.
Yes, and then focus your attention accordingly. And I think once people do that, once you know that attention is a selective process, it's either this or that, and you know that you have a finite amount of it, just out of sheer efficiency, you would want to spend your attention, your mental money, on the things that you say you most value. And I think in our culture right now, that is often not happening.
What are suggestions that you have in terms of helping people identify the priorities that you talk about? and particularly when someone is confronted with a question from an acquaintance. What's new and exciting?
What's new, I find myself saying to my husband at the end of the day when he comes home, I'll say, what's new? And it's actually kind of a stupid question because I should be saying, what's important? You know, they are two very different domains, but they both overlap in the sense that we tend to think, instead of prioritizing what's most valuable and important to us, we prioritize what's new and different. And we need to take ourselves off autopilot and get back to our priorities. Sometimes I will sit down at my desk and I'll take out a piece of paper and I'll make a list of my priorities, because sometimes I forget what my priorities are and I have to remind myself.
Well, Winifred Gallagher, author of Wrapped, Attention and the Focused Life, thanks for being with us again on Radio Curious. And I'd like to ask you, in terms of ideas and concepts that you've reviewed lately, what's important?
Well, I'm lucky enough to have a wonderful Tibetan Buddhist Lama friend, and I love something that he said to me once. Whether you're meditating or just living your life, try to pay attention to just being present rather than being caught between hope and fear, which is the mind's usual condition. Another way to say that, stay in the present rather than being caught between the future and the past, which is where your mind wants to go, left to its own devices. I think that's a very profound place that he has identified, present.
And Winifred Gallagher, can you tell us about an interesting book that you've read lately?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I am reviewing a wonderful new book called Delete, The Virtue of Forgetting in the Digital Age by an information expert named Victor Meyer Schoenberger. And he makes a very powerful case for being, one, very cautious about what information about yourself you put out there in the electronic domain, and reminding us that just having total recall of everything isn't always necessarily such a good thing to do.
Winifred Gallagher, thank you for being with us on Radio Curious.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Winifred Gallagher is the author of Wrapped, Attention and the Focused Life. This program was recorded on November 30th, 2009. The book that Winifred Gallagher recommends is Delete, The Virtue of Forgetting in the Digital Age by Victor Meyer Schoenberg. Winifred Gallagher was previously a guest on Radio Curious in 1999, commenting on her book entitled Working on God. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious are available on our website, which is www.radiocurious.org. You can also subscribe to the Radio Curious podcast by clicking on our website. Our programs are also available in CD format. To get a copy, visit our website, radiocurious.org, for further details. And at Radio Curious, we appreciate your thoughts and ideas about our programming and do enjoy hearing from you. Our address is Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. Our email address is curious@radiocurious.org, and the phone number is 707-462-6541. You've been listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Thank you for joining us.